Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Algie Hall. How are you doing, Algie?
Hi, very well, thanks, John.
Excellent. And Phil Oakley, how are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thank you.
Good, good, good. Right, so there's been lots going on this week, lots of profit warnings, and I think we're going to discuss one of those in particular, Somero, which you've written about in your Alpha report. We're also going to talk about your stock screen this week, Algie, which is focused on large cap quality, which I know is a theme that Phil likes to explore frequently. Certainly the theme behind your fantasy SIP, which continues to do very well. And I'm going to talk about cycling, because I know you love cycling, Phil, and we've got a big sex focus on fitness, the fitness market, because we have a big IPO coming up in the US of a company called Peloton, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Yeah.
Let's start with quality and the stock screen. So, Algie, you've talked through what you've done this week, because you've kind of taken a sort of slight change of tack here.
Well, yeah, it's actually last year I looked at this stock screen and I felt I'd compelled to take a change of tack. I mean, it did very well for a number of years. But it had this kind of valuation criteria where it was looking for quality and an attractive valuation, which is often very wishful thinking. So last year I ran the screen and it came out with practically all house builders, and the screen had been creeping more toward in this direction over the years, and it was just like, it's gone too far. Things have to change.
This goes back to the principle that you wrote about recently, Phil, which is that the numbers don't always tell you everything. Numbers might look good and suggest quality when it's perhaps not there.
Indeed. I think trying to buy quality at a cheap price is almost impossible in this market.
Yeah.
It has been for some time.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's definitely what a year ago it seemed like this. Yeah, it was a complete joke, the output from this screen.
Well, I think what you end up with, actually, and I've not looked at your screen yet, is that you end up with what I've a new term of mine, which is quality traps.
Ooh.
Where you end up with businesses this is on a pure numbers basis without knowing anything about, and obviously we're talking about screening here and highlighting the risks of just looking at numbers, but you can end up with businesses, particularly cyclical businesses, which are making very good profits at the top of the cycle and look very cheap. And they'll come up very nicely on
exactly.
your screen.
Very good reason for the price the market puts on them.
And actually, Somero, which we've already mentioned, which we're going to talk about,
yeah,
is a very good example.
Indeed
of that.
It is, yeah.
Sorry, let's carry on, Algie. What have you done then?
Well, so anyway, last year I just felt this is ludicrous. This isn't a quality screen at all. It's late stage cyclical screen. So I changed the valuation criteria to look for reassuringly but not excessively expensive shares based on basically a PEG type measure. And I mean, when the screen started out, which was in 2011, you could actually get qualities, it was coming up with names which you would associate with being quality companies, which were looking good, attractive on a PEG type measure, but it just doesn't happen anymore. And anyway, sometimes it's, cyclicals will outperform quality shares, but recently that's definitely not been the case. And the results from last year's screen, where we've got the old criteria delivering a minus 0.1% total return versus the choices from the new criteria producing a 21% total return, it kind of bears out that actually if you're going to, as Phil was saying, you've got to pay for quality, especially late on in a bull market as we are now. And it's paid off over the 12 months the screen's looked at.
And they are the names, I mean, looking at last year's selections, names that you would expect.
Yeah, so yeah, Diageo, Rolex, Unilever, and Reckitt Benckiser, which, does have a few issues. But And then it's a bit more diverse this year. We've got more. I've kind of done an extended list of shares, but only three of them passed all the tests of the screen, and they're Diageo, Games Workshop, and Spirit Sarco.
Ah, Diageo.
Which are, Diageo.
It's a proper old reliable, really, isn't it?
And I mean, they all of that. I suppose Games Workshop, maybe I felt in terms of writing them up, is possibly quite interesting, just from the fact that it's kind of been through this period of recovery, and now the question is, can it achieve, you know, growth at whilst generating really quite high returns?
Mm.
And there's a bit of an unknown because it's a niche. That's why it's a quality company, because it dominates a niche effectively. And so how valuable is its intellectual property? How international is it? All those kind of...
I think it's a very interesting company, actually.
Yeah, and I think...
It's a workshop. I think it's in a very, very sweet spot. And just a bit of sort of scuttlebutt for the listeners. I was... A friend of mine paid a visit to a competitor of Games Workshop's private company, which is Warlord Games. And he went around the factory. If you were a shareholder in Games Workshop, you would come away feeling quite happy because I think the market is incredibly buoyant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things for Games Workshop is that it is tapping into a very powerful theme, a powerful wave of demand for its products. And of course, it makes all its own stuff. It makes a lot of its own stuff. It's got a factory in Nottingham. And so you've got this classic sort of operational leverage story as well. Once you've made the molds for these figures, the marginal cost of making the next toy soldier or whatever you're making is very small.
Well, it's plastic. It's a tiny bit of plastic.
Yeah. But the scale economies and the operating leverage on a business like this is pretty powerful. And,
I remember I used to cover this stock. In fact, I love this screen analogy because I tipped two of these three companies years ago, Diageo and Games Workshop. And Games Workshop, it was a scuttlebutt type thing. And sort of, it was a bit overlooked at the time. People didn't really like the story.
It's been overlooked for you know, years because it was so unfriendly to the stock market. Even their product launches were basically when and where they wanted to launch it.
There was a bit of controversy. At the time, though, which was that when the market decided it didn't really like Games Workshop, there was a bit of a falling out with its customers because it switched from metal models to the plastic ones, which went down very badly. But they've recovered from that, and, you know.
Well, I mean, his core customer base is incredibly loyal, and I think they, what part of this kind of revival of fortune since 2015, they kind of slightly watered down the rules to one of their role-playing games, and there's apparently outcry.
But I mean, for me, though, the big risk of this company is it is, or seems to be, incredibly dependent on one theme, which is the mm-hmm. Warhammer thing.
Yeah, I mean,
it's got a massive market. It's international.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah.
It's, you know, this but is a global phenomenon.
But if it ever cools, if enthusiasm for this product ever cools, then you will see it. You will see it show up.
There will always be young boys interested
I suppose on one side of it, you say, you know, is it a, you know, a fad like them? I don't know. Well, Loom Bands is what comes to mind. Well, there'll be an enduring... Then you look at something like, you know, the way comic books have been turned into this, you know, the IP's been exploited in ways people would never have dreamt of about 10 years ago.
Well, that's an interesting aspect of this story, isn't it? The exploitation of their intellectual property beyond the sort of core business of selling fantasy figures.
So this is what you're doing. You're getting behind the numbers here, which is exactly what people should do. I think it's a super business, really.
With stock screens, it is the first step always. I mean, yeah, and sometimes you'll get something really interesting. And sometimes you'll get utter rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing that sort of, you know, you think about it, Games Workshop is, you know, you compare Games Workshop, say, with a Diageo, and you think, you look at the demand patterns for Diageo, and they're pretty steady. And you ask yourself, could you sort of have a rough back of the envelope stab at how much money Games Workshop's going to make in 5 years' time compared with Diageo? I think it's quite difficult.
It would be, very. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it could be a lot more or a lot less. You've
than
got
what
that
you expect.
Speculative element because it's having to invest in its business now, so returns will drop, but they should still be handsome from Games Workshop.
But it's adding 50% more space to its
capacity because there's so much demand. It's got to, you know. But I mean, that's great news, really, because you want a company like this to be able to invest in growth.
Yeah,
growth is there, I mean, it's it's so compelling.
Once that capacity utilization of that new facility, you're going to get a nice kicker on it.
Quite, years of improving returns after the initial investment.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's almost a unique asset on the stock market. I'm trying to think, is there anything else which sort of plays that kind of theme?
Wait, I mean, if you go back, you had something like Hornby, which is not massively different in sort of in terms of like the sort of philosophy and trend behind the business. It's a hobby type business with international appeal,
which was totally ruined.
Well, it was wrecked
by the management team.
It was so but, you know, but that's also something
like Hornby is a bit more like something like Port Merion. They're kind of collectibles rather than. I mean, this is had these, you know, toys have narratives behind them. They do kind of books.
Are you suggesting
games
that? Are you suggesting that various toy locomotives do not have deep stories behind them because they do?
I'll take it all back.
You've
done more fun with an Intercity 125 and a teacup.
Oh, there was a great documentary, I think I've mentioned it before, about what happened to Hornby. It was just bad management.
Oh, it's very, very sad. Very, very sad what happened to that. You think of the brands that, you know, they had Hornby, Scare Electric, they bought Airfix as well. Mm. All these sort of iconic brands, and they completely messed up their manufacturing.
They stuck all their moulds. They outsourced everything to China.
They did.
And then they chucked all their moulds away.
Yeah,
all their factory tooling.
First of a job.
Yes, it's shocking. So bad management. Bad management. That's what we want to be watching out for here. Bad decisions, and so far no sign of them. So far
everything's going well. It looks like.
Should we talk a little bit about Spirax Sarco? Because I know that's one that you've written about in your column, Phil. That's also popped out of this screen.
Mm-hmm.
It's expensive, and I know you've looked at it with that in mind previously. Another great business, but
one of my favourite businesses, actually. I think this is what, if you ask me to name, you know, a short list of outstanding businesses listed on the London Stock Exchange, this would be close to the top of the list.
Mm. Too expensive, though?
It's very expensive. But an example of, I just like everything this company does in the, Not just from the numbers that come from it being a fantastic business, in that the products that it makes, it is a classic problem-solving productivity business enhancer. It's a bit jargonistic, but it's very good at solving problems and making things better for its customers. And it is utterly superb at getting inside its customers' businesses and working with them and building long-term partnerships with them, which means they get a lot of repeat business. And it's got its fingers in many pies. So it's very much a play on global industrial production. So it will occasionally have its ups and downs, but it's proven to be an incredibly resilient business. And I think that is why this is a business, along with other types of business, that in the last 10 years, people have been prepared to pay higher and higher prices for.
I mean, there's been a few worries recently. And the graph, I mean, this stock screen is peppered with fantastic graphs illustrating the financial points you're making. But there is a little bit of softness in the forecast.
What I've tried to illustrate, it's the valuation point. This is a, you know, without doubt, a great company. You know, a standout quality play, but the ratings got so high that there's been a 10% share price fall on the back of slightly soft half year results, which was 1% downgrade or something.
It had a problem. It has a business called Chromalox.
So,
and there was a problem with this business in terms of things being not as good as they wanted to be.
Yeah, it's the European losses, isn't it?
Yeah. So the core sort of steam business and the Watson-Marlow pumps business doing okay. It's the Chromalox business, which is part of the steam business, which is an acquisition they made 2 or 3 years ago, which has not been going well, and hence you didn't get an upgrade to forecast, which when you were trading on getting close to mid-30s forward price earnings ratios, you needed one. And you didn't get one.
Yeah, and the title of this graph is The Price of Less Than Perfect. So when shares are so highly rated, when the expectations are so high, any weakness can send a shiver through the stock.
And it's still on 29 times forward earnings. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of like you've had quite a large fall in share price terms, but it's the shares are still, you know, you'd struggle to describe them as cheap, I think. Despite the underlying quality.
Is this a problem with buying quality more generally?
Yeah, definitely.
The big risk is a very small disappointment can see a big share price drop.
Yeah, it is. But also, you have an issue where you look at the underlying growth rates of a lot of these businesses, Spirax, Unilever, Reckitt-Benckiser, Kaiser, Diageo. These businesses aren't racing away because a lot of them are big. They're already big and it's hard for them to get much bigger. People are paying high prices for dependability. It's the sort of bond proxy, bond-like argument. People believe or they're subscribing to the view these companies' profits and cash flows are so safe, so dependable and growing that they are incredibly valuable. You have to subscribe to that to buy into this. And so far, that's paid off. But you are absolutely right. If we get a situation where the profits stop growing or don't grow as much by expected, there's nowhere to hide in these companies. And, you know, I've banged on about this for months now. And that this is the big risk that if you look at some of the best performing funds out there in the market in the UK, these global blue chip growth funds are owning these steady state chuggers, as I call them, highly profitable, dependable businesses. The prices now are incredibly high. The valuation is incredibly high. You've had a currency benefit for them as well.
That's something you talk about in your Alpha report this week. And there is a concern that, I mean, sterling is obviously on its knees at the moment. You know, any sign that the political environment might get a bit better, you know, you could see the pound bounce back against currencies like the dollar. And that could be bad news for some of these.
Very bad news. You know, you go from having a following wind to a headwind. And, you know, you just have to look at the S&P 500 as an example of this, that, you know, when I wrote my sort of main article for the magazine this week, I think the S&P was up just under 16% in dollar terms. But if you'd own an S&P 500 tracker, you're up 23%. A little bit of dividend in there, but not much because the yield is not. So you're getting six and a bit percent currency benefit added on top. And you look at these funds, the Linzel Trains, the Fundsmiths, the Smithsons, huge exposure to dollar earners, dollar listed stocks, and there has been a big currency kicker there. Still done fabulously well. Not going to take away any of the performance benefit from their stock picking, which has still been extremely good. But there has been a very favourable following wind for this style of investing.
Guess we'll keep an eye on currency then with these very large dollar earners in particular.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, you mentioned actually before we came onto the podcast that Nick Train had made quite an unusual investment in the last week or so, which sort of goes off style for him.
Well, it's a bit on and it's a bit off because he's bought, they've been buying into Prada, which is listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. And it's sort of the luxury goods theme. So they already are investors in Burberry. So it's a kind of area that they know pretty well. But Prada has not been as... Nick Train's whole philosophy has been buying, and this is to use his phrase, buying businesses that have already won. And Prada has had a very rocky time. Its shares are down about a third over the last 12 months. Things have not been going that well for it. And he is essentially buying in because he believes it can become an excellent business, which to me is a slight change of strategy for him because he's not buying a business that's already won. He's buying a business that he thinks should be winning. And it's going to be very, if it comes off, his hope will it be that it'll be a make a lot of money for him. But maybe it's a reflection of the fact that he's had a look around the market and looking at the prices of businesses that have already won and thinks they're too high.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It does have that sort of flavour about it.
Which is interesting because, you know, to be fair to him, he doesn't buy stuff very often. I think the last thing that he bought was racking my brains here. I think it was Remy Quantro. Yeah. We'll see. Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's stick with another big dollar earner, but one that's not done so well of late, which is Somero. So Somero makes concrete levelling equipment.
Screeding, yeah.
Screeding.
Yeah, sort of thing that if you go into, you know, a building and you want to make your concrete floors nice and smooth and flat and level, you get one of their machines out and does the job for you.
Yeah, they didn't use one in my extension, that's for sure. Never mind. But it's had a bit of a take. The shares have taken a bit of a tumble this week.
I think they've halved, haven't they, this year? If you look at the share price chart, they halved, pretty much halved.
Pretty much.
What's going on? What's going on? So we referred earlier to the idea that this might be a quality trap.
I think it is. It is one of these businesses. If you just look at the numbers, it is very, very profitable. If you like looking at numbers like profit margins, return on capital employed, big ticks when it's going well. This is a business that obviously is heavily plugged into construction activity. So when people are building lots of things, demand for their machines and their spare parts and all their other bits of kit is very, very high. And you've got quite a lot of operational leverage in this business as well. So changes in sales and profits move more than the changes in sales.
Yeah, so there was a big operational gearing effect here. So revenue's down 13% and a bit, pre-tax profits down nearly 23%.
Yeah. And this is a business where, you know, I always say when you're looking at investing in any business, go and look. First thing you do is you look at recession resilience, and you go and look at the last recession, and you have a look at what these companies perform like when things are going bad, and then you ask yourself, is this business any different to what it was then? What has it done to sort of protect itself from that going forward? And if it hasn't, if it's basically the same business, then you have to think that it's vulnerable to a downturn. And what we've seen this year is we've seen this company makes most of its money in America. It does have businesses in Europe, Middle East, China, but most of its money, most of its sales are being made in America. And we've had some bad weather, in the spring in America, and that led to a downturn in demand, which was the first big sort of profit warning that we saw in June. And then we have the half year results this week, and there has been a sort of, it's very interesting when you look at companies, going off at a tangent here, that it's often not what the company says but sometimes what it doesn't say. And you look at like the range of the sort of revenue forecast for the year, and I think that the range has broadened a little bit with a sort of lower downside number. And whilst there's a lot of optimism about orders coming through in the second half of the year, the profits aren't coming through for this business.
I mean, it says that the US non-residential construction market remains healthy.
Yeah.
And that's what we're largely seeing. So what is going wrong?
Well, the European business is a lot weaker.
Right.
There has been some delays in orders elsewhere in the world. And you have a situation where you've lost orders in the first bit of the year, and you're not probably getting enough business coming through to make up for that.
I mean, also, this company doesn't really have any or much follow-on revenue, does it? It doesn't.
No after-sales, you mean?
I don't think it's got much in the way of after-sales, so it is actually just selling these bits of kit up front. And then they do a rent. Do they have a rental arm? Maybe, or but anyway, I mean, yeah. So sales can, I think, can fall like really horribly.
Well, you've seen it. You've seen it in the numbers. You know, the sales are off. Sales are off 13% in the first half of the year. So you are reliant on selling machines.
Yeah,
that is the bread and butter of this business.
I mean, that's kind of classic. Road to ruin in a down cycle.
There is some aftermarket, but it's not you know, it's not the big part of it.
I mean, you mentioned, Phil, you know, look back at a previous recession and see if the business has changed.
Yeah.
What can a business that's inherently cyclical, like Somero, or there's many other industries that we look at that are inherently cyclical, what can they do protect themselves?
Not a lot is the answer. I mean, one of the answers is to develop an aftermarket business.
Yeah, or turn into a rental business, not actually sell the kit.
Yeah, but, you know, still have it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for a rental business, you know, first thing that happens when is that you get
no, then you, you own your kit you own back. Yeah, yeah, you've got all the capital.
So no, it's plugged in to a cyclical industry, construction. So you can't get away from this. So, you know, you look at a business like this. If you were running a screen.
It would look amazing. Yeah, it looks amazing at the moment.
You know, it looks amazing. You've got incredible levels of profitability on a single-digit price earnings ratio. You see, my view is that, you know, the market doesn't give away free lunches like this very often. And it's the same with house builders. You know, house builders look great on a screen like that. And, you know, if something looks too good to be true, it often is.
Yeah, and it seems kind of perverse saying I want to pay more for something, but I mean at the moment definitely if you're looking for quality, don't think it's going to be there. You know,
how does this business grow really? Because you know you've had a big following wind in this market, in its core market, for the last 8, 9, 10 years. The Chinese market has promised a lot, but it's never come through. The European market's gone a bit soggy, and things like the Middle East seem to be very lumpy, and you know you never seem to get a consistent trend going on there. And you know you ask yourself, is this like a house builder really? This like a Barratt Developments or a Persimmon, where the good money's been made for now, and actually, this is as good as it gets profit wise. Mm. You know, you don't know, but you are. You have to think that on a lot of cyclical businesses, you look at what's going on in the world economy, and you think it's slowing down. It's not really take a rocket science to think that perhaps things have been as good as they can be for now.
Yeah, I'm often struck as you by the commentary around your stock screens, where you are having to kind of work out the cyclicality behind the stories, behind the numbers that are coming out.
Well, I mean,
it's a common theme.
Yeah, no, you've got it. They have to be seen, explained, and seen in context. And I mean, with the stock screen column, the whole point is to cover a very broad suite of approaches.
I think the whole point of the stock screen is that it's your first step.
Yeah, it's your way in.
It's an idea generator.
Yeah,
it's not a painting by numbers exercise.
Yeah, you can't just. I mean, obviously there are those, you know, black box style investors, you know, quants and stuff, who do have strategies based on, you know, criteria. But I think, as I always say in the columns in the magazine, you know, these are not. Presented as anything, you know, these aren't presented as off the shelf portfolios. Although,
but some would work as quant strategies. I'm sure.
Shorts.
I mean, with quant strategies, though, the thing is, these things, when you look at them, I mean, they're, you know, some of the numbers over the long term are good, but they're incredibly volatile, a lot of them. So, I mean, I don't know if people would be bailing out of the quant strategies.
The thing is, with this kind of thing, is you end up with a huge amount of churn as well.
If you're
going to invest like this, you are turning over huge chunks of your portfolio every year to meet a certain.
Yeah.
Well, that's why momentum is the classic.
Completely,
It's a strategy that wins every time, but you can't trade it.
Yeah. It's just too expensive to implement.
The other thing about, you know, momentum is, you know, it's all very well putting in the historical results, but, you know, sticking your dealing costs and your spreads and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Shall we quickly talk about Barratt? Because you mentioned it very briefly there in the context of cyclicality. And as you mentioned earlier, Algie, it kind of was in the old style large cap quality screen. And it's done surprisingly well this year. I mean, most of the time we talk about house builders on this podcast, it's in a very gloomy context, but these numbers looked okay. How is Barratt bucking what seems to be a quite a difficult time for this industry?
I don't think they're bucking it.
No,
if you look at most of the house builders, they they seem to just be eking out some modest profit growth. The trends are quite similar in that volume, selling more houses is getting harder to do, and selling them for more, i.e. getting selling prices to go up, seems to be getting really difficult. And the builders always, you look at their average selling price on their private housing, you've got to strip out the affordable and social housing element of this. From what I've been seeing out over the last few weeks, that average selling price inflation is very sluggish. And they'll say, oh, well, we've changed the type of house we're selling, but I'm not sure I completely buy that. I think we've had a situation in this market where new build selling prices have gone up so much now, and that they are so far out of kilter with existing stock in nearby neighbourhoods, that these builders cannot put their prices up anymore. Mm. And you marry that up with build cost inflation of 3-4%, and it's very, very difficult to increase your profits. What Barratt's done here, which has eked out about a 4.5% increase in full-year profits to a pretty big number now. I think it was 901 million, I think their operating profit was for the year to June. They're playing around with their designs. They're trying to sort of get building efficiencies, cut some costs, and build more efficiently. Now, that's not always a good thing, as we've seen.
But their shares have done very well in the past 12 months, certainly relative to some of the other house builders.
Yeah, I think they've not had the clouds over them that, say, a Persimmon has or a Bovis has. And they have been trying to grow by volume rather than price. And what is very clear from looking at Barratt's and other builders, actually, is that they have got a lot of profit in their land bank. They are very, very bullish about their land bank. That they are first and foremost, they're running quite short land banks. This is the reassuring thing for shareholders, is that if you are going into a downturn, you're not sitting on 10 years worth of land. You're sitting on 4 years worth of land if you're Barratt's, a little bit more so you've got about just under 4 years of stuff that you own, a little under a year of stuff that you've got an option over or control over. You're not sitting on massive land banks, which leave you very vulnerable if the weather changes in terms of the market. And they're saying that they've got land here that's making 23% gross margin, 25% return on capital. Which business owner wouldn't want that? And you've got a market that's still supported by Help to Buy until 2023, unless you get a change of government and a change of policy, which is always possible.
But almost probable at the moment.
Yeah, the Labour Party are even more bullish on were even more bullish on it than the Conservatives at the last election. They wanted to keep it until 2027 in their manifesto. The one thing you have got is you've still got this build cost inflation. But you know, if Barratt's just kept the level of houses that they bought and that they built and sold flat, they would still make very good money. Mm. And you know, they're not on a high rating. You know, as long as the market stays intact and you don't get a big downturn, then if you're a shareholder in Barratt's, it's a matter of what I think about the whole Help to Buy thing. If you look at the facts, then as long as things hold up, then this is a business that looks like it's still going to keep churning out pretty steady profits, steady cash flow, decent dividend.
Yeah, absolutely. We prefer the brickmakers, though, at the Investors Chronicle. I know you do, Phil, but yeah. We've got Mitchell Merce results this week's mag.
Yeah,
we've got them on a buy.
I like Mitchell. I like all of them, actually, Ibstock and Forterra as well, which I think was one of our tips for the year.
Yes, it was.
I think the UK brick market looks, you know, again, if you look at it from the perspective of a business owner, looks really good. I mean, you've got very low stock levels. You've got a house building market that is well supported by subsidy. You've got demand greater than supply. Mm-hmm. And
and no more supply coming, really.
You've got imports coming, but that's good for Mitchell Merce because mm-hmm. they've bought Belgian brick company. So they'll be shipping things in from Belgium. You know, you have to look at bricks. I think the cost of bricks, the overall brick cost is, in terms of the actual cost of the house, is about 1%. So it's not, it's something that you've got a bit of pricing power on, and the builder's not going to really kick back too much. So it's looking pretty good. The thing I like about this, these types of businesses, yes, they're cyclical. You have got quite a decent repairs and maintenance side to it, which gives you a little bit of support. But what you've got is that you've got these three companies that own clay assets that make it very difficult to compete with. You know, if you don't own the, if you don't own the clay pits and the reserves of clay, you can't really make bricks at a competitive price. You know, and Mitchell Mertz has got 6.4 million tons of clay and 20 years of supply on 125 million bricks a year. That to me is kind of business I wouldn't mind having a slice of.
Maybe it goes back to the conversation we had a couple of weeks back about, you know, possible UK takeover targets. This looks nice.
Yeah, this to me, I mean, it's about 87 million market cap. This is also a sector that's, you know, there's been a lot of takeovers and changes of ownership. I mean, Fonterra has changed hands three times in the last 15 years. And, you know, it started, it was Hanson Brick. And then I think it got bought by Cemex or someone, or Heidelberg or Cement, I think. And then it became Fonterra. I think private equity owned it.
Mm.
Yeah, I think these are nice businesses. Yes, they will have their ups and downs, but they own incredibly scarce assets.
Mm-hmm.
I like them.
We like bricks, not concrete so much. Should we round off by talking about exercise, my favourite subject? I do loads of it. As you can tell by my svelte figure.
Yes,
the sector focus. Let's talk about the sector focus, which is about the fitness market in the UK, which apparently is massive, I'm told. I know you love a bit of exercise, Phil.
These days, yes.
What's going on here? So we've got the Gym Group, which is listed in London.
Yeah.
Quite a pretty successful business. There was another gym company that was due to float, Pure Gym, but I think markets got a bit rocky earlier this year when that was going to happen. And now in the US, we've got a really big one coming, which is Peloton.
Yeah.
Which is the sort of cycling fitness, the Netflix of cycling or something they call it. What do you think about this one?
I wouldn't touch it with a bar prop.
not even as a participant.
No, not even, certainly not as a participant, which is why I wouldn't touch it as a stock.
Why not? Tell us why.
I think the product's incredibly expensive for starters. I think, I'm not sure the exact figures, but I think you're looking at best part of 2,000 quid for the bike. And then you're looking at about £40 a month subscription.
You've looked at it as a possible customer then?
No, just out of pure nerdiness and interest.
Because I know your other great passion is cycling.
Cycling and rowing. I'm more into rowing at the moment.
Oh, you're into rowing, okay.
But I am a big cycling fan.
Yeah. I read your tweets, Phil. It's either how much you love cycling, something about investment, or how much you hate Guendouzi of Arsenal.
Steady on. I was singing his praises at the weekend. He did well.
Okay,
when the facts change, you change your mind.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, indoor fitness, cycling, indoor cycling, I mean, we all know that, you know, or some of us know that in a lot of parts of the country, you go out on your bike and you literally take your life in your hands.
That's why I don't do it.
And that's why I increasingly don't do it outdoors. And you've seen phenomenal growth in marrying up this big popularity of cycling with technology, where there's nothing worse than going in your garage, sticking your bike on a turbo trainer or a set of rollers and trying to pedal.
Nothing worse.
Well, I over-exaggerate there, but it is incredibly boring. What these fitness companies are trying to do is they're trying to make it a bit more interesting. And so they're marrying up fitness with the tech, so it becomes interactive. So you can interact with the fitness program and other people. You can race other people. You can train with other people, and that's how you get people onto these products. And Peloton is trying to do it with sort of interactive spinning classes, where you can be sitting. If you've seen the advert on the TV, it's a lady pedalling away whilst her baby's playing with, or kids playing with the toys, and she's got some bloke on the other end of the screen telling her how to spin.
Okay.
And
sounds great.
Yeah, and you know, making it look great. But it's very expensive. There's a lot of competition in this market. Another company that's been advertising extensively is a company called Zwift, where you link your bike up to a bit of software and you have it on a television screen and you have interactive racing and you can race with people around the world. Incredibly competitive. In fact, it is Zwift has become so popular that there has been a rumour that the Giro d'Italia, which is the second biggest cycling race in the world after the Tour de France, has even been mulling the idea of starting the race with a Zwift time trial, where they all race each other on a computer and the first leader is based on a Zwift time trial.
It's like esports.
Yeah, it's
the real thing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think this is a big theme. I think cycling, indoor exercise, you just go on the internet, there are huge amounts of people exercising indoors, not just in gyms, but in their garages, and anything which makes it more interesting, more exciting, I think is going to be very popular.
You do some kind of interactive thing with your rowing, don't you? You mentioned that the other day.
Yeah.
Rowing against...
I don't row against anybody, but I've got an app which records it all.
Right. Go head-to-head with Stephen Redgrave.
No, not yet. Actually, I'll probably give him a run for his money at the moment, actually.
Wow.
Depending how fit he is.
I mean, my experience of the fitness market, which is very limited indeed, but as an analyst, as a stock market observer, I remember when there was a big, big surge of fitness coming to market, probably 10, 15 years ago, maybe a bit more, and it didn't end well.
Let's take a step back on this and just look at it how you should look at any investment. And you say, look, how much competition is there? Mm-hmm. This is the most important question here. Where's the competition? The answer is there's lots of it. There's lots of it. You've got literally new products being launched every week in this space. Peloton, I've not really had a close look at it. I read something maybe a week or so ago, and I think there's a lot of red ink over this business. I don't think it's making any money.
It's not making money. It's making huge losses. And there's been some questions over the numbers as well.
This is a business, really. You know, it's like Uber, and it's like making loads of losses. It's selling a story, and it's something that an investor, in my opinion, shouldn't even go anywhere near.
What about something like the Gym Group, which is obviously the UK listed? And you know, this model is different. It's low-cost gym memberships. Seems to be doing very well. It's, you know, would you say, could you look at that and think, okay, there is something here? You know, this is...
Possibly. I've not looked at it. So
that's your homework, Phil. Let's have a look at this.
I mean...
I think there's still growth in the market, which from what they're saying anyway, which suggests there's still money to be made for the time being. It's a saturation point, isn't it? When they've all got their, you know, they're kind of up to the eyeballs with their leases and, you know, maintenance of, you know, the actual gyms, and then suddenly they don't start, you know, they start losing.
Are they expensive customers? I mean, you've obviously got the overheads. Well,
the model is that these are incredibly cheap by comparison to, the predecessor gym. So I think, you know, you can have 24-hour access and you have some kind of, you know, cards.
You
hardly see anyone when you're in there apart from the other gym goers. And there's certain footprints which they want in terms of the property they're buying, which make them, you know, very cheap to run. But I mean, it's not, I don't know if there's anything so special about putting this together that means that, you know, people aren't going to compete away the margins.
Which is exactly what happened.
And then you're locked in there because you've got your estate and you need
a lot of customers.
Yeah.
To make it work. You know, I get it. If I can totally understand the proposition to the customer, because one thing that puts a lot of people off gyms, and the many things that put people off gyms, but one of it's the cost. you know, the monthly costs. If you can get something which is affordable, then you can see right away that's something that will pique consumer interest. But, you know, you do have overhead, and you need, you know, if you're going at a lower pricing point, you've got to make reasonable money by selling to a lot of customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if there's a lot of competition, then essentially they sort of can compete away the margin.
Yeah, and I think if you make it easier as well for people to train at home, you know, people train in their spare rooms or garages so they don't have to go out, and they can do it for, you know, modest outlay, that's also a threat. But as I say, I've not delved into this.
It's interesting. It's a massive growing market.
It's
I know.
Interesting business model.
I think it's definitely something we should pay more attention to. It's a real trend. I mean, it seems to be the sort of opposite trend to, say, the pub trend, which is going the other way.
I still
go to the pub, incidentally. That's my exercise.
Of, negative
you know,
correlation.
A lot of young people, you know, getting into this. I think you've got a lot of sort of older people getting into sort of cycling and stuff.
Mm.
And pubs
closing.
But no,
it is the negative correlation.
But you know, health and fitness is. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe. I mean, I just in my own sort of age group, sort of circle of friends, a lot of people go to the gym who, you know, maybe for the last 20 years have been not doing much exercise at all. So it's definitely, you know, just look at the growth in the, you know, the personal trainer type market as well. Mm. And obviously that's a different income set, different demographic, but it's, the trend is definitely there. But as we know with investing, sometimes the trend, the macro trend, doesn't mean that you can necessarily make money out of it.
Well, it becomes a great narrative that you know, sort of overhyped investments get pinned on.
You can definitely raise money at IPO on a story like that.
You've got your macro market level, and then you're not dealing. That's what you need. You need is that's your following wind, as you say. That's your sort of rolling road. But you need to harvest that. You need the micro side of it to support it. So you need. I always say, you know, if I explain this to my kids, you're looking at, you know. One of them starting to get interested in investing.
Wow, that's good.
And you know, when I talk to him and say, look, what's good about this, Dan? And I say, well, it does something that not a lot of others do. And I said, you've got to look for something, a business that does something that isn't being copied by lots of others. I'm not sure that this space ticks that box.
Mm, absolutely. That's enough talk about fitness. It's making me feel like I ought to get out and do something. Let me just talk you through what's in the rest of the magazine. So we haven't talked about Phil's column, which is about negative interest rates and what investors can do about them. We have discussed that
We've
on this
that
podcast
death, haven't we, John?
Several times. We have indeed. We have lots of the personal finance and funds section, including a look at equity income funds, which is actually part potentially of the solution to negative interest rates. Bearball's written a double length column following up actually on our conversation about potential UK takeover targets resulting from the weak pound. And John Barron is in this week, and he's actually looking at the UK as well and why perhaps it has been oversold. Lots of results in the mag, lots of news, and a really quite interesting feature from Daniel Liberto on cash hoarding. So companies that basically sit on too much cash and why that could potentially be a bad thing for your returns. So thank you, Algie. Thank you, Phil. And thank you all for listening. Pick up the magazine, All Good News Agents, Cash Hoarders, Why Frugal Companies Could Be Hitting Your Returns. And we'll be back again next week. Thank you.